So today is the last week of our study in Proverbs. This is week 13, if you can believe it. I know it has just flown by. We have been having a good time. And so I started thinking, how are we going to bring this whole thing to an end? How do you land the plane? And of course, the most natural place to end is in chapter 31 with the woman of valor, the excellent wife, the Isha Chayil. That's been done before. And I thought maybe we could do some sort of summary, review, and go over, kind of hit the high points over the last 12 weeks. But then I thought, I wasn't really paying attention. And then I decided what I want to do is end with a different type of writing. We looked at the speeches at the beginning. We've looked at poems in the book. And we looked at a lot of these little couplets in chapters 10 to 31. What I want to do at the end is look at a collection of riddles in chapter 30. So we're going to be in Proverbs 30 this morning. And the reason I wanted to teach on this is because it gave me the perfect excuse to spend some time in this chapter and say, what on earth is going on? Why does this chapter matter? Why do these words, why do these riddles matter? Why are they here? And what's the payoff for understanding them and spending time with them? So, we're going to look at seven numerical riddles. The beginning of the chapter says the words of Agur, the son of Yake, the oracle. We have no idea who Agur is. This is the only time in the Bible that this name appears. His name means to gather, for what that's worth. And what we're told is that what follows is an oracle. Now, the word oracle, we don't usually associate that with wisdom writings. What kind of writing do we usually associate with the word oracle?
Prophecy.
Prophecy. So, as we're reading, it's still the book of Proverbs. It's still wisdom. But maybe we should be thinking of this more as something kind of prophetic. Maybe there's something else going on here. And in the first few verses, which you can read yourself, Agur kind of remarks about how stupid he is. I'm just a stupid human, and I can't understand things. I haven't learned wisdom. I don't have knowledge of God. Who can do all these things? And then he takes solace in the words of God in verse 5. Every word of God proves true. So there's some sense in which he's like an ideal reader of the book of Proverbs. He admits his own folly and his own shortcoming, but then he turns to the scriptures, and the scriptures are what give him wisdom. So amen to that. And then what follows, beginning in verse 7, is the set of seven numerical riddles with a few intervening verses here and there. Other than the first one, the other six are four things that are placed side by side for our comparison and our delight. Usually there's some sort of heading. There's one or two that don't have a heading. And so it's up to you, the reader, to ponder and reflect and meditate and discern, how are these four things similar to each other? Or how do they correspond to the theme? What's the relationship between all these items? And then once you figure out what the relationship is, what's the payoff of understanding that? Why does that matter? That's what intrigued me about this chapter. And so here's what I'm kind of kicking the tires on. Here's my experiment for the morning. Maybe the riddle is meant to invite reflection on what other types of things could be included in that list. What are some other things that go along with that? Now, I may be wrong. Maybe this is not what we're supposed to do, but I'm going to take this for a test drive and y'all can be my guinea pigs. Okay, sound good? Sounds good. So, why are these riddles preserved? I also want to test drive the idea this morning that these numerical riddles are not preserved just for posterity, just for the sake of preserving them, but that they are, in some sense, prophetic. These are a word that are for an oppressed class of Jews living in exile. They are preserved through the fall of Jerusalem and through Israel's time in Babylon. because these are somehow teaching them how to live and survive when they are on the underbelly of society. Now, by the time we get to the end, you may say, Parker, that was a stretch, but we'll see. We'll test it. Okay, so I'm hoping for a lot of discussion, by the way. So here's your first riddle. He says, two things I ask of you, a prayer, and deny them not to me before I die. Remove far from me falsehood and lying, and give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. So this is Agur's prayer to the one who can make him wise. And what does he pray for? Two things. It's not a trick question.
Specifically in there, what's he praying?
Yeah, specifically in there.
He's, for not to be too full.
Not to be too full or empty.
Say what?
Or empty.
Yeah. And so not to be too, and not to be too rich or poor.
Yes. So give me neither poverty nor riches. That's actually the second thing he asks for. What's the first thing he asks for? To not be surrounded by lies. So I want to suggest that falsehood and lying and poverty and riches are parallel ideas to each other. That poverty is a lie and wealth is a lie. His prayer is, first of all, not to live in an illusion, and then also not to have too much or too little. And I'm saying that having too much creates an illusion, and having too little creates an illusion. Scarcity and abundance both tempt us to believe something false. What does, if we have too much, what are we tempted to believe?
That we'll live forever.
That we'll live forever?
And we'll never have enough.
And we'll never have enough?
We can do anything. We're in control.
We can do anything. We're in control.
Don't need God.
Yeah, and so I might be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? What is the lie if we have too little? What are we tempted to believe?
God doesn't love us. He won't care for us.
Yeah. Okay. So God won't provide, and we need to secure bread through our own cunning and deceit and theft. And for Agur, that is profaning the name of God. So for people in exile, this is an important prayer. Imagine what it is like to be living in exile, far from home. You're at the bottom of the social ladder. Don't give me so much that I deny the Lord and jump ship and assimilate. And say, I don't need the... Apparently God can't look out for me anyway, because here we are in exile and deny you. But also don't give me so little that I bring shame on the name of my God by stealing. I want to continue to be a faithful Jew living in exile. So give me just what's needed for me. It's about contentment, which is why John read this passage in his class on contentment. Okay, so that is the first riddle. How are we doing so far? We got six more to go. We excited? I'm excited. Okay, it just gets better from here. All right, so here's your second riddle. There are those who curse their fathers and do not bless their mothers. There are those who are clean in their own eyes but are not washed of their filth. There are those, how lofty are their eyes, how high their eyelids lift. There are those whose teeth are swords, whose fangs are knives, to devour the poor from off the earth, the needy from among mankind. So this one doesn't have a title to tell you, or any kind of heading to tell you what these four things have in common. So I'll ask you, what do these four things have in common?
A hierarchy. There's some that are better than others.
Maybe there's a sense of hierarchy in each of them. a law unto themselves. I like that turn of phrase. Any other ways that you would put it?
I see pride and then cutting people down with their rules.
Pride and cutting people down. So here's how I titled this. Groups that rot society. I would submit that all four groups are the kinds of people who undermine society and accelerate its decay. The first is cursing parents, people who sever themselves from the past and ignore the wisdom of their ancestors and their forebears and who deliberately shun and curse their roots. A society full of parent cursers is not long for this world. And then clean but filthy. They say that they're clean, but they're actually filthy. What does that mean?
It's a lie.
It's a lie?
On the one hand, because I think about people who just say something over and over and over till other people believe it. Mm.
Just say it enough times and it becomes...
Doesn't make it true. It just means that I'm saying this. But you could also say that they're deluded if they really believe that. It didn't say they believed it. It said they say that. So that to me says that's an outward thing. Okay. Saying this to other people.
Okay.
Having touch with reality. I think they're just users of their own gain with no thought of what they may do to others.
They're just users with no thought of how their own actions affect other people. And then, Jane, you said they're out of touch with reality. So the passage this made me think of is in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, "Why do you see the speck in your brother's eye, but don't even notice the log that's in your own eye? You hypocrite." It also makes me think of Isaiah 5, which is not so far away, just a few pages to the right. Isaiah 5, verse 20, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." People who have inverted what is good and what's not good. And they say, "We're clean," but actually you're not clean. That would rot and undermine society. And then you have lofty people whose eyes are lifted up. It's an idiom for pride. Pride makes a society calcify. It makes the society unable to change. When you're proud, when you have a moment where you're dealing with some pride, what's the one thing you don't want to do? Change. Right? Because I've nailed it. I've nailed it. And so when a society is marked by people whose eyes are lifted high, they have no ability for self-criticism. No ability to receive criticism, and so they cannot grow. And then their teeth are swords, taking advantage of the poor. What other types of people might we add to the list? What are some other groups that might rot society? There are those who...
Lazy.
Entitled.
Stingy.
I feel like y'all have been paying attention the last 6 weeks because you just named like three of the categories that we worked on. I think this is valuable to people in exile because it's alerting them to the kinds of behavior that are going to be unsustainable on the underbelly of the empire. If you want to retain your group identity, that we are Jews, even here in Babylon, you cannot curse your mother and father and cut yourself off from your past. You cannot invert what is good and what's evil like Babylon does. You cannot be proud. You're going to get trampled on. And you're not in a position to take, if you were to take advantage of the poor, those who are going to be poorer than yourself, you're just going to destroy each other. Okay, thoughts or questions on riddle number two? All right. We'll move on. This is my favorite one. The leech has two daughters, give and give. Three things are never satisfied, four never say enough. Sheol, the barren womb, the land never satisfied with water, and the fire that never says enough. Four things that are never satisfied. And the whole thing about the leech and the two daughters, first of all, a leech? Think of one other place in the Bible where the word leech is used. I can't think of one. But four things that never say enough. Sheol, what is Sheol? The pit. It's the grave. It's the grave with a capital G. It's the cemetery. Although cemeteries can fill up, but the grave never fills up. Why is the grave never full?
Because
everybody's going to die. There's always room for more dead. And then the barren womb.
Say what?
The barren womb. I believe the barren womb is never satisfied. Well, I think what he's saying is no amount of seed planted in the barren womb will ever make it produce. So you have this, the first one is about the end of life, and then the next one is about the beginning of life. You see that pair? Okay. And then the third item, the land that is never satisfied with water. It's unclear to me if this is like a particular parcel of land that's just not good for anything. You just can't raise anything on it. That'll never grow anything. Or is it about the fact that the land always needs more water? You water it, and then your crops grow, and you harvest, but you need more water again next year. You're always dependent. What's interesting to me, you have Sheol is the end of life, the barren womb is the beginning of life, but then there's a link between the barren womb and the land because they both have to do with seed, producing from seed. You see that connection? Okay. And then fourth, the fire that never says enough. A fire doesn't get halfway through destroying something and then say, I'm good. Now, it may run out of fuel, but that's different. That's just it has destroyed everything that it can. The fire itself isn't satisfied. So you have water, and then you have fire. So link, link, link. Okay, what is the payoff for seeing how each of these things is never satisfied? This has always befuddled me. Okay, if I sit there long enough to realize, okay, these things are never satisfied, what? How does that help me? This is where I wonder if it is inviting us to ask, what are some other things that are never satisfied? The glutton who just eats and eats and eats and is never full. I feel personally attacked. I wonder if Agur were writing today, might he have included things like the laundry machine is never satisfied, the dishwasher never says enough. There's always more. What else never says enough?
Money.
Sure.
Money?
Like, even though you're doing good, I want to eat this or that. Or money, material things, I guess.
Sure.
It's funny, I was looking at the word leech, and it means the root of it is to suck. And I was like, you're never, like you say, never. But it also drains everything.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I was wondering, with the leech has two daughters, give and give. Mm-hmm. I was thinking leeches don't give squat. They take and take and take.
Yeah.
But I don't get the give and give.
Oh, because they say, give me, give me, give me.
Oh, of course they do. Yeah.
It's interesting how it's daughters, not sons.
Yeah.
Oh, and is it, are the names of the leech's daughters give and give? And the leech has named its daughters the same thing because they're all alike. Or is give, give what the daughters say?
In my Bible, it says give, give, they cry.
Okay, yeah. So the word cry is added, but it could, that's a fine translation, is to put it in quotes. This is what the daughters say. Somebody read for me Proverbs 27, verse 20. Nice and loud. And somebody else, Ecclesiastes 4, 8.
Children and bad are never satisfied, nor are the eyes of men ever satisfied.
And Ecclesiastes?
4,
8.
There was a man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom do I labor and deprive myself of pleasure? This too is futility, and it is an unhappy task.
Okay. So both of those are pointing to the same thing. The eyes of man never being satisfied. And even in Ecclesiastes, it's a man who works himself to death and never stops to ask, why? Who's going to get all this stuff? The eyes of man are never satisfied with riches. I would say that dissatisfaction is another word for greed. The inability to be content. And as long as we're talking about greed, I'll just name two groups that seem never to be satisfied. And then we'll just move on. Tax collectors and retailers never say enough. They always want you to come back. So, is this meant to be a warning that's reminding us of Proverbs 27:20 and the danger of greed? That when we become greedy, it is somehow a participation in death, in barrenness, in aridness, and endless consumption. If you're in exile, a greedy heart is a nightmarish vice. To be greedy and to be at the bottom is not a good place to be. Okay. Thoughts or questions on number 3?
Why is the 3 and then 4? What is the difference? Well, the 3 things that are never satisfied, what are they versus the 4 that never say enough?
Oh, so it's a good question. Hebrew poetry is built on parallels. So you'll have two lines that are somehow interacting with each other. A common way that that happens is the A line is synonymous with the B line. The Lord is great. He is mighty. It was the same thing. Sometimes the A line and the B line are opposites of each other. Like those who bless, no, that's synonymous. An evil man is ensnared in his transgression, but a righteous man sings and rejoices. Opposite. And sometimes the B line builds on the A line. So the Lord is great. He is most high above all gods. Something like that. Takes the A line and makes it even bigger. And that's what's going on here. 3 things are never satisfied. Oh, no, wait. 4 are never satisfied. So that the B line is actually what you're going to think about. Does that make sense?
Back to include leeches, because they're never
guess they do drop off.
What about the barren womb? Sheol?
You're counting that and barren womb separately. Okay.
I also said at the beginning that you have these numerical riddles, and then you have these intervening verses from time to time. And the leech is one of those intervening verses. It's not part of the riddle, but it's certainly where it is on purpose, because it's a number and it's connected to it.
I also noticed that none of those things are things you can control.
Can you control greed? I don't know. I'm just shooting from the hip because I think this is inviting us to think about greed. That's worth a cup of coffee, probably. All right. Number four, the mysterious ways. Do we have any children? We got a little ears. So three things are too wonderful for me. Four, I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky. The way of a serpent on a rock. The way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a virgin, or your Bible may say with a young woman. So four things that are astounding for me, four incomprehensible things, and they all have the word way, Derek, way. These all pertain to movement, motion. An eagle. How does that thing not fall out of the sky? And I know there are people today who, you know, engineers or whatever, but look at it. How does it not fall out of the sky? The way that a serpent moves. I saw a snake slither away. I won't tell you where because it's nearby. But I saw a snake the other day. It was a little one, but like, how? It's so fast. How does that thing move? And then a ship on the water, I'll never understand. All these are one thing on top of another thing and moving. And in each case, the movement is somehow mysterious. And then the fourth item is the zinger. The way of a man with a young lady. I think this is certainly a reference to sexual intimacy. There's something mysterious and wonderful about this. Its ability to create new life, to unite two into one, and to elicit pleasure and delight. And then I think the next verse is not placed where it is on accident. Verse 20, this is the way of an adulteress. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I've done no wrong. You remember in the early chapters of the book, we met the adulterous woman. And she liked to eat. What kind of feast did she have? She's a predator. She preys on fools. Right? The young man who walks by her house and then is enticed to go in for dinner but doesn't realize that he's the main course. She's going to destroy him. Okay. The creation mandate in Genesis 1 is to be fruitful and multiply. And if you remember, when Israel was in Egypt, they continued to be fruitful and multiply to the point that Pharaoh was terrified of them, right? They're fulfilling what God has told all humans to do. And when they are in exile, that fruitfulness, I think, is here being commended as something that's beautiful and mysterious when it is sought within proper boundaries. It's a reminder of the creation mandate through this mysterious ways. Questions? All right, we're going to keep moving. We got three more of these. Time's getting away from us. So, things that creation can't handle. Under three things, the earth trembles. Under four, it cannot bear up. A slave when he becomes king, and a fool when he's filled with food, an unloved woman when she gets a husband, and a maidservant when she displaces her mistress. So other than the fact that they make the earth tremble, what do these four things have in common?
They're out of place.
They're out of place. It kind of reminds us of riddle number two, the groups that rot society. There's kind of an out of order disruption to this. Okay, here's what I think is interesting. Can we think of any time in the Bible when a slave becomes king, or practically king?
Joseph.
Okay, what book is Joseph's story in? Don't forget to make your wager. Okay, Genesis. It's Genesis. Yeah. How about a maidservant displacing the mistress? Can we think of anywhere in the Bible where there's a female servant who begins to sort of taunt and lord it over her mistress?
Hagar.
What book is Hagar in? Genesis. An unloved woman getting a husband. Can we think of any story where there is an unloved woman who gets a husband?
Leah.
What book is Leah in? Genesis. I don't know who the fool is that gets filled with food, but those three suggest to me that we're supposed to be thinking about Genesis here.
Would that be Jacob?
It's possible that it's Jacob. Jacob is the one that I was thinking of because he's filled with, well, Esau is filled with food that he didn't. Yeah, Esau trades his birthright. Okay, so all four of these, I think, and I'm not certain about the third. I'm just test driving. You guys do the hard work. All of these, I think, pertain to the book of Genesis.
The maidservant and the mistress, what about Sarah?
Yeah, Sarah and Hagar? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, you just said and, that earlier, sorry.
And then the unloved woman, that might be Hannah, although Hannah is the loved woman. And it's the rival wife that is the unloved. But I think we're supposed to think about Leah. So the book of Genesis is this collection of stories about the foundation of Israel. It's the founding story of Israel. And each of them is a disruption. Israel is founded on stories of a slave becoming king, an unloved woman getting a husband, a maidservant who displaced her mistress. This is all part of their story. And for someone who's sitting in exile, this may simply be a challenge to the idea that all is as it should be. Yes, the earth trembles under these things, but these are the kinds of things that brought Israel into existence. Just because you're sitting in exile doesn't mean that's how it's supposed to be. Maybe.
The only one I would question there, and I mean, when you read this, it seems to be indicating these are not beneficial for them.
Mm-hmm.
Just reading this on the surface, Joseph obviously is very beneficial for them, for Israel and for Egypt.
To a degree. I mean, Joseph is also the one that winds up getting them enslaved in chapter 47. But they survive the famine, but then they wind up as slaves. But then maybe the slave can become king again. Yeah, they're all, I mean, obviously they're not positive things. They make the earth itself tremble. Creation itself groans when these things happen because things are out of order. All right, number six. I like this one too, because I have no idea why this is in the Bible. So four things on earth are small, but they are exceedingly wise. The ants are a people not strong, yet they provide their food in the summer. The rock badgers are a people not mighty, yet they make their homes in the cliffs. The locusts have no king, yet all of them march in rank. The lizard you can take in your hand, yet it is in king's palaces. Okay, thanks. Thanks for sharing that, Agur. First of all, how do each of these demonstrate and embody wisdom? How does the ant demonstrate wisdom?
They work together, yeah.
They work together, and they...
provide their sustenance.
Yeah, they store up food for the summer. Not for years to come, but enough for daily bread. The badger, the rock badger, which I know we're all just... that's probably your spirit animal, right? Is the rock badger. They make do with what they have. And they make their homes out of the way. Nobody's going up into the cliffs to go hunting or something. So they find themselves a good place to live. What about the locusts? How do the locusts embody wisdom?
They work together.
They work together even though...
they don't have a leader.
They don't have a leader.
They don't have a king.
They don't have a king. Ah, so do you need a king in order to work together? You don't, do you? Locusts can do it. And then the lizard, or I think some translations have the word spider. That might have been an older translation. But anyway, the lizard you can take in your hands. It's found in king's palaces. Why is the lizard wise? Or how does the lizard demonstrate wisdom? All right, done with this. I'm going to put that down. He doesn't care if it's a palace or a yard. Does anybody at your house, if you find a spider, do you let it live?
No, sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes.
So Kate...
So
we have like pretty tight insulation most of the time, but in the ancient world, right, they don't have pane glass. It's pretty open. Things can get in and out, little critters like that. Why might they not want to kill a lizard or a spider?
It'll eat other insects.
There you go. So it may be that the lizard demonstrates wisdom in sort of earning its keep. Or it may be that it infiltrates the palace because it's a lone ranger. I'm not exactly sure what we're supposed to be drawing our attention to. But why, think about this, why would Agur draw attention to the wisdom of things that are small?
Because
they can seem insignificant. Yeah, I mean, until you like leave cookies out and you got an ant trail in your house, then it's not so insignificant. But yeah.
All things matter.
All things matter.
But it's also easy to see the big things. If there's a cow that comes to your front door, that's really easy to see, but it's not always easy to see the small things. We don't always pay attention to the small things, and we just get distracted by the big things.
Okay, so let me suggest this. Since the time is getting away and we still have one more. Now just think about the church right now. It seems as though the church is getting smaller and smaller and less significant. Would you agree with that? On the whole, exceptions duly noted. Do you think maybe there's some wisdom in looking to other things that are small but wise? Savvy, surviving by their cunning? I think so. Does being small mean that you can't make it?
This reminds me of David and Goliath.
David and Goliath? Mm-hmm. Say more about that.
Well, Goliath was his giant. David was small, yet powerful.
Yeah. And powerful because of his wisdom.
Right.
He knew better than to stick his nose, get too close to the guy that has the 17 arm reach, 17 foot reach. Okay, here's the last one, and this is my favorite, and this will be Alicia's favorite also. Three things are stately in their tread. Four things are stately in their stride. The lion, which is mightiest among beasts and does not turn back before any. The strutting rooster, the he-goat, and a king whose army is with him. Okay. First of all, does anybody have a different translation than strutting rooster? I know there are a few translations that have that, but I think that's pretty well the dominant translation, is the one that is girt of loins. That's what it literally translates to, but because the first and third are animals, I think we're using a little bit of imagination of things that are stately in their strut. What is the effect of comparing a king to the lion, the rooster, and the goat? Just assuming for a moment that this is a rooster, have you seen a rooster strut in front of hens? It's ridiculous. It's like a middle school boy trying to impress teenage girls. And that's the image for the king who has an army. Fluffing up his tail feathers, making himself look bigger than he is. You have the lion, who's really strong. The lion who never retreats. And the rooster and the goat. I think it's a humorous picture, and it's sort of mocking the king. If you believe that a king and his army can accomplish anything, then strutting, that strut is intimidating. But if you believe that a king can accomplish only what God allows, then his strut is a farce.
Well, and he struts before the battle, too. After the battle, even if he wins, he wouldn't be strutting because of the sacrifice of his people, of his men. So that's a going into. That's a...
All right, that was the bell. That was the second bell. So next week, we are on to the Gospel of Luke, which I am looking forward to. Thank you guys, not just for today, but thank you for the book of Proverbs. Thank you to John and to Steve and to Paul for also contributing to this.